Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I'm going to begin with what I call paradox of aging. As people age, we all get physically disabled. We lose memory and some of the other cognitive abilities slowly. At the same time, people often feel good about themselves as they age, and that's the paradox of aging. Then I will talk briefly about some of the recent studies about sexual function and satisfaction in older age. Next, several positive psychosocial traits, optimism, resilience, spirituality, social engagement. Then comes one of my favorite topics, which is wisdom. Then how does the brain function in old age? Does it, can it grow? Can some neurons and synapses increase? So that's the neuroplasticity of aging. And finally, the implications. What does this all tell us about how we can age successfully? So starting with paradox of aging. When we started our work on successful aging here at Stein, the very first question was, how do we define successful aging? So we looked at the literature, and we found there were 28 studies that had something to do with successful aging. And between the 28 studies, they had 29 different definitions of successful aging. This goes on to show that there is really no consensus single definition. However, the most commonly used definition applies to physical health. So most people think about successful aging as meaning no physical disease, no physical disability. The second most commonly used one is cognitive function. That means cognitively the person is intact even in old age. So this is the usual notion about successful aging. This is a 94-year-old man who ran a marathon. This slide actually is from 6 years ago. Just a few months ago, he turned 100 and ran another marathon. This is an 89-year-old woman who went skydiving for the first time. There's a problem with the definition. The problem is that most of us are not going to be so lucky to have no diseases, no disabilities, and that we will not only live up to 100, but be able to run a marathon at 100. So that definition, the problem is, it means that most people are aging unsuccessfully. And is that really true? So we started our study with a detailed survey questionnaire, which included several standardized rating scales for physical health, emotional health, depression, resilience, physical activity, and so on. And we also asked a question about where do you rate yourself on successful aging on a scale from 1 to 10. 1 is the worst, 10 is the best. And we didn't tell people how you should define successful aging. We just said, tell us where you rank yourself on that 1 to 10 scale. We have studied more than 3,000 people in the community during the last few years. We did not include people who were in nursing homes, because they would not be able to complete the survey, but almost everybody else was there. So these are not mountain climbers and so on. They are the usual seniors that you and I see out there, between 60 and 100 years of age. And this is important. Only 18% would have met the physical criteria for successful aging. There is no disease and no disability. So if we use the common definition of successful aging, 82% of these people would have been called unsuccessful agers. So we wanted to find out what they themselves thought about their aging. And this is what we found. I told you this is a scale from 1 to 10. 1 is the worst, 10 is the best. So most people gave themselves 7, 8, 9, or even 10. So in spite of physical illnesses, disabilities, the usual social stressor, many of these people had diabetes, hypertension, some had cancer, they had heart disease. Quite a few of them had lost their spouse recently, their other stresses, and yet they thought that they were aging successfully. So What do they really mean by aging successfully? So we did some qualitative studies. We ran 12 focus groups, including a total of 72 people, and 22 individual interviews of people who were living in the community, again, excluding people in nursing homes. What we heard from them is that for them, psychosocial factors, attitude, and adaptive behaviors were more important than not having disability or disease. They said it doesn't matter if you have disease or disability. So long as we have positive psychosocial factors, attitudes, adaptive behavior, we are fine. And they defined successful aging as balance between self-acceptance and self-contentedness on one hand, where you say, I have hypertension and diabetes, and that's fine. Everybody in this age group has that. So they accept the fact, and they are contented with it. At the same time, they're not passively accepting it. They are engaging with life. They're continuing to grow. They're continuing to learn something. They're do some physical activity, etc. So they define successful aging as a balance between the two. And these people made several other criteria for successful aging, non-physical criteria. Independent living, positive adaptation, engagement with life, mastery, growth, etc. And the main predictors of this self-rated successful aging were high levels of positive psychosocial traits, resilience, optimism, attitude towards aging. I'll talk about each of those shortly. In terms of health, low level of depressive symptoms and self-rated health, and very importantly, activities. And three types of activities, physical, cognitive, and social. So those were the predictors of successful aging in this population. So what is aging and what is successful aging? Aging is really not one thing. So there are actually three different kinds of aging, three different kinds of functioning that we are talking about. One is physical. We are all familiar with that. Then there is cognitive functioning, our memory, ability to learn new things, and so on. And there are lots of studies of physical aging, cognitive aging, but very few studies of psychosocial aging. And that's something we are doing here at Stein Institute. So we are looking at self-rated successful aging, which reflects kind of quality of well-being, emotional health, and positive psychological factors like resilience, optimism, wisdom, etc. And these three don't go hand in hand necessarily. Even when the physical health declines, cognitive functioning gets a little worse, still the psychosocial functioning can be at a high level. Now, all this is based on survey, and the survey is done by the people themselves. So one question is, how reliable is that? How valid is it? So there is something called social desirability bias. You know, whenever somebody asks us a question, we may tend to give responses in a way that makes us look good. So if somebody asks me if I have any kind of bias about age, gender, race, even if I have a bias, I will say no, because it makes me look good. So that's a question that comes in. Are people them saying that they are aging well? Because it's good to say that. So we did a study in which we used there's a scale for social desirability. And what we found was that the scale had high internal consistency. It seemed to be a reliable scale. But we found that socially desirable responding did not influence questions related to physical health, self-rated successful aging, and attitude toward aging. As a matter of fact, self-rated health is the best predictor of physical diseases and mortality. Self-rated health is a better predictor than anything else you can measure objectively in terms of predicting mortality. So self-rating are actually quite valid for some things. And so this showed that clearly what we are measuring, several of those items are indeed valid. We published a book called Successful Cognitive and Emotional Aging. Colin Depp is my younger colleague. As Maureen mentioned, we recently started a new study. Why did we start a new study? Because I talked to you about this previous study that we did in 3,000 plus people in the community. In that study, we took the people who wanted to participate, who wanted to do the survey. So when you take a population like that, the question is often it may be biased. You know, people who are aging well, they want to complete the survey. Those who are not aging well, they won't want to complete a survey. So that's often a problem when you do studies, what is called samples of convenience. People who come to us and we give them survey. So we wanted to do a different kind of a study in which we would select people on a random basis. And that's this SAGE study, Successful Aging Evaluation. That's what SAGE stands for. So the goal of this study is to test a hypothesis regarding different domains of successful aging. And by that I mean physical, cognitive, psychosocial, longitudinally, and in a randomly selected sample. So we contracted with a survey company that have data on four numbers of tens of thousands of people. From that, they randomly selected some people whom we approach, and then, as Maureen said, we completed 1,300 phone interviews. 1,000 of them completed surveys, sent us their saliva sample, which we'll be analyzing in the near future for genetic analysis. And what makes this study unique, one is the randomly selected sample, but the second one is our focus is on resilience, optimism, compassion, wisdom, positive traits. Most studies on aging that are going on, they focus on Alzheimer's disease, diabetes, cancer, or heart disease. We want to find out not why people don't do well, but why some people do so well. And what we find is, in terms of cognitive functioning on telephone screening, both in men and women, there is slight decline from the age of 50 to 100. That's not surprising. We would expect that memory and learning ability would go down some with age. This is the percentage of people who have no physical disability. Okay, so at 50, at the age of 50, 60%+ people have no disability. By the time you pass 90, fewer than 10% are free of disability. So this just shows that physical health declines. Not a surprise. But look at this. This is the surprising finding. Self-rated successful aging actually goes in opposite direction. So as people get physically sicker, their self-rated successful aging improves. That's the paradox of aging. When I show that slide, people often say that's California sample, San Diego sample. It's people in California all smoke pot and they're all happy, and so it doesn't apply. This is a study that was done by using Gallup survey. This included 340,000 Americans all over the country. And they did a phone interview. And just like we asked a question on successful aging, they asked a question on overall quality of well-being. And they asked people to rate themselves, just like we did. And they had a sample ranging in age from 18 through 85 plus. What they found was this quality of well-being was very high, quite high, in the early 20s. It came down progressively, hit the bottom around 50, and then mysteriously it started going up. And in the 80s, it was similar to what it is in 20s. But if you look at just this curve here from 50 to 85, that's exactly parallel to what we found in terms of self-rated successful aging. See, you see this one, self-rated successful aging, how it increases? The question is whether it is survivor bias, yes. In the sense, sickest people die young, and then so what are left are the people who are healthiest. That's definitely a possibility, and there is no question that it. However, I don't think that's a main explanation, because there have been several studies in which people have been followed for long periods of time, and you find that as they age, they start doing better in terms of their self-rated quality of well-being. Now, why does that happen? And we will discuss this at length. I think this is a very good question. What happens, I think, in the early 20s, you feel that you can do anything in the world. You are going to be the president of the whole universe. And then as sort of reality hits you, you start coming down in your expectations. And around 50, that's the age of midlife crisis. When you really feel down, you feel that you have not accomplished what you set out to do. You look ahead and you say, I'm not never going to accomplish that. And you question what you did, whether it is worth it. But then what happens is your perspective changes. You say that at the age of 80, you don't compare yourself with a 20-year-old and say how disabled I am. You compare yourself with people you are born with, and you say many of them are not alive anymore. I'm so lucky that I'm alive. I'm not in a nursing home. I still can do several things that other people could not. And I have actually accomplished a lot. Like, you know, my children grew up, and then I did my job or whatever it was. And you feel good about yourself. So that's the paradox of aging. And actually, sex is a good example of this paradox. Why? So in our study, we had 1,200 postmenopausal women in this Women's Health Initiative study. And we gave them a questionnaire that included a number of questions about sexual activity and functioning. And what we found was that the older the women, they had less sexual activity and functioning, but it was actually still significant. I will show you in the next slide the exact numbers. Okay. So this is sexual interest. And so this yellow bar shows women in the 60s, red is in the 70s, and the green is in the 80s. And the sexual interest clearly goes down. However, another way of looking at it is that even in 60s, 65% women have sexual interest. In the 70s, half of the women have sexual interest, and 30% in 80s. If you look at sex in the last 6 months, more than 50% of the women say that they have had sex in the sex with or without partner, sexual activity with or without partner. And one of the big problems why the sexual activity goes down in later life is lack of partner, or even if there is a partner, the partner is disabled. And that really is the most important factor for reduced sexual activity and functioning in many of these women. Another point is that in spite of that, still you see more than half having sexual activity in the 60s, about 40% in the 70s, and 15% even in the 80s. But look at the sexual satisfaction. There is no change. So you see, again, paradox of aging in the sexual field, that the sexual activity goes down, sexual satisfaction does not go down. Now, this was based on our study in this Women's Health Initiative. Another study just came out, and this was a study done by Dr. Barrett Connor's group in Rancho Bernardo. She has been studying this Rancho Bernardo cohort for many years. And as you know, this is socioeconomically higher level population than the one we included. In this population, again, she found that 50% reported sexual activity in the prior month with or without a partner. 2/3 reported arousal and orgasm. And this is interesting, that they reported that what was important for them was emotional closeness during sexual activity. That accounted for the sexual satisfaction more than anything else. There is some literature suggesting that estrogen therapy increases sexual activity. They didn't find that. So the conclusion was that sexual satisfaction in this study actually increased with age, but did not require sexual activity. So this is really a good example of how physical functioning and psychological satisfaction are divorced.
Excuse me. How can you have sexual satisfaction without sexual activity?
Sexual satisfaction here means that they are overall satisfied with their sexual functioning. It is something like this, that person who is, say, physically disabled, maybe in a wheelchair, you ask that person how he feels about his physical functioning, and he said, actually, I feel fine. Because again, it's a question of whom you compare with. And so here, these women were not comparing themselves with those in the 20s, but they were happy with what they had, the sexual activity they're having. They didn't need more. Now, we are in the middle of looking at the data in men. And it'll be very interesting to see what the aging men, whether we find a similar relationship between sexual activity and sexual satisfaction. Maybe at my next presentation, we'll have those data and show this to you. Okay. Then going to these positive psychosocial traits, optimism, resilience, spirituality, social engagement. Now, when we talk about successful aging, why is it that some people age successfully? And usually we think somewhat correctly that genes are important. Sometimes you see families in which everybody's living to 90 and 100 and everybody's functioning highly. And there are others in which people die in the 40s and 50s. So clearly genes are important. And we did a survey, we did a review of the literature to find out which genes were associated with successful aging. And APOE4, I think many of you know, probably associated with Alzheimer's disease. Some inflammatory markers like interleukin 6 and 10, the sirtuins are associated with aging. Anyway, so we found some genes that seem to be associated with successful aging. However, the question is, how important are these genes? This is a very nice study done by Barry Gerland. He and his colleague, they looked at nearly 2,700 twin pairs. These were all veterans in their 70s. And they found that genes accounted for only 22% variation in the functioning in the 70s. Environment and behavior accounted for 78% of the variance. So the genes are important, but not that important. They account for only 22% variance. So if we are not aging well, we can't blame the parents and their genes. So how do we explain this? We are born with the genes and we die with the same genes. So how can the genes not be important? Well, they are important, but the expression of genes changes according to environment and physical behavior. For example, we know this, that smoking increases the risk of lung cancer. So if we have twins, one of them smokes, the other one doesn't, the smoker will have much higher risk. Now, both have the same genes, but smoker is more likely to develop cancer of the lung. We know the effects of hormones, nutrition, come back to that, effects of stress, physical activity. Psychosocial activity and its effects on gene expression have not been studied. And that's, again, something we want to do here that will be unique for Stein Institute, that looking at the effects and the relationship of these psychosocial traits, positive ones especially, their relationship to gene expression. So starting with optimism, a couple of years ago, the Time had a cover story on optimism bias. What is optimism bias? It means the belief that the future will be much better than the past and the present. And they reported that older adults are just as likely to see the glass half full as younger adults. So there is stability in the level of optimism that continues. There are a number of studies showing how optimism is helpful. I just want to show you one study. This was a Dutch study that was published in Archives of Internal Medicine. They studied 545 men aged 64 to 85 who had no cardiovascular disease or cancer to start with. And they completed a survey similar to what we had done, and they had a scale on optimism. Then they followed these people for 15 years. What they did was they divided the people into three groups. This group was the most pessimistic, this was the most optimistic, and this was the middle one. And this is mortality from cardiovascular disease. So if it comes down faster, that means there's higher mortality from heart disease or other cardiovascular disease. What they found was this tertile, this third of the people who were most pessimistic, had twice the mortality of the most optimistic people. And this is after controlling for the factors that we all want to control for: age, gender, ethnicity, family history, use of statins, smoking, etc., etc. So this was not clearly related to some other artifact. Now, it doesn't mean that if you're optimistic, you'll live forever. It means probably they're optimistic people that took better care of themselves. They probably ate good diet. They had physical activity. They had more friends. Whatever it is, the fact that something is associated with 50% decrease in mortality from cardiovascular disease, it is incredible. If I told you that there is a drug that reduces mortality by 50%, all of us would want to take it, right? So that's optimism. Resilience. What is resilience? It's the ability to adapt positively to adversity. And we use a scale called Conner-Davidson scale for resilience. And we found that resilience in older people is somewhat different from resilience in younger adults. There have been some studies of resilience in younger adults, and people have found some factors. In older people, we found that the factors associated with resilience were personal control and goal orientation, adaptation and tolerance for negative effect, leadership and trust in instinct, one's own instinct, and spiritual coping. And we found that higher levels of resilience were associated with higher emotional well-being. They felt better about themselves. These people tend to be more optimistic. They had higher scores on celebrated successful aging. They're more likely to engage socially, and they had fewer cognitive complaints. So resilience was associated with a number of good things. Now, I mentioned something about spirituality, and I want to spend just a few minutes talking about religiosity and spirituality. There are varied definitions of these. One thing is that these two concepts overlap, but they are not synonymous. You can have, actually, you have some spiritual people who are non-religious. Some atheists can be spiritual. And even the reverse is occasionally true. Some religious, extremist religious groups may not actually be quite spiritual. So, but by and large, they overlap. So what is religiosity and what is spirituality? This is one definition that is published by the Duke group, Dan Blazer and Midar. Religion, as you know, is an organized system of beliefs, practices, rituals, symbols, etc. And so religiosity means you participate in such system. And spirituality, on the other hand, does not necessarily need religion. It can have religion, but it goes beyond that. It seeking understanding of answers to the ultimate questions about life and its meaning. So you go beyond the material world, and however you define that. So we did a study in which we used a scale for spirituality in close to 2,000 women, older women. This is the San Diego population, and we found that 40% reported regular attendance in organized religious practices, like going to church. 53%, so even higher proportion, reported private spiritual practices, for example, silent prayer. And spirituality was associated with higher resilience. Interestingly, it was also associated with being single and lower education and lower income. So it probably might mean that people who have fewer resources by being single and fewer resources by being less educated, they often find spirituality necessary or useful for success. There are a number of studies that have been published in the literature on spirituality, and people have reported a number of associations of spirituality with positive things, such as better adaptation to and faster recovering from physical illness, lower mortality, lower rate of depression, lower smoking, lower alcohol use, better quality of life, better cognitive functioning. However, there are a number of limitations to the literature because different studies use different definitions. They use different scales for measuring. Self-report bias, you always have to take into account, especially when you look at some sensitive items like religiosity and spirituality. Also, there is some debate about what exactly helps. Clearly, it helps many people. But it has two aspects. One is the behavior, outside behavior, and one is inside attitude and things you do inside. For example, going to church is one thing, and that is associated with several things. If people who go to church regularly, they may go with their friends or family, and once you are in the church, obviously you don't smoke, you don't drink, you don't use substances, you are kind to one another. You need self-discipline to be able to do that. So all of those positive things go with that kind of religiosity. On the other hand, spirituality, especially self-directed, may involve just, as I said, silent prayer or belief in something that is not material. So which of these things actually work? There is some suggestion that it is object, the behavior, outside behavior, that might be related to these positive outcomes more than the inside one. But again, I think much more research is needed in this area. And solid scientific research where we use data using standardized rating scales, follow people for a longer time, use controls, and so on. So, okay. Lastly, among the positive psychosocial traits, what about social engagement? Social integration and support are associated with protection against hypertension, cardiovascular disease, depression, cognitive performance, etc. This study just came out just a couple of years ago. It was a very large review of nearly 150 studies on social support. And what they found is really incredible. They found 50% increased likelihood of survival for people with stronger social relationships. And this is true, they found, across age, gender, initial health status, cause of death, follow-up period. Again, think, again, if there were a drug that was associated with 50% increase in survival, you know, how much we would value it. And yet, we don't think about social engagement as being that important, or optimism talked about earlier. Same thing about religiosity and so on. Those are important things. And really, so what we need to do is study them biologically as well as psychosocially. Okay. A few words about wisdom. What happens to cognition with age? As you get older, clearly some things go down. We have a harder time remembering names, remembering faces, learning new things. For example, all these new gadgets and technology coming, that's much easier for our kids to work with them than for us to do that. So that is called fluid mechanics. So those are the things that decline with age, those abilities. However, not everything declines. Some things continue to be preserved. For example, vocabulary. In people who read and write regularly, the vocabulary continues to improve. And often you see people in the 60s whose vocabulary is better than that of people in their 20s and 30s. So if you keep yourself, there are some other things also we don't forget. For example, things we learned long time back. If I learned biking or swimming at the age of 5, I'm likely to do well in biking and swimming even after I develop dementia. So that's called crystallized pragmatics. So some things go down, some things stay stable. The interesting question is, can anything get better with age? This is Dr. Montalcini, Nobel laureate, and she said my mind is, she celebrated 100th birthday. She said, my mind is sharper today than when I was 20. Another Nobel laureate, Eric Kandel, he's 81 now. He said, I think I do science better now than I did when I was younger. In science, judgment is so important. I have a better understanding of which problems are important and which are not. So people are talking about things that they actually that seem to get better with age. So what is that wisdom? So what is wisdom? The concept of wisdom is very old. I mean, it's a religious philosophical concept going back to old Greek period. Sophia is a Greek goddess of wisdom. The word philosophy means love for wisdom. But wisdom was not studied by scientists until a few decades ago. 1970 is when empirical studies on wisdom started. And as you'll see, in the last decade, there has been explosion of research, I mean, relatively. Still, not enough studies, but at least many more studies than there used to be. So wisdom in the Bible, there are several books of wisdom. In the Hindu religion, there is the Gita, which is kind of the Hindu Bible. And we did a study, qualitative study, using qualitative methodology, looking at components of wisdom in the Gita. And we also looked at the wisdom in the modern definition. And we found there was surprising similarity in the concept of wisdom from the ancient times to now. So what is wisdom? There is no single consensus definition, but it seems that many people agree that wisdom includes several things. One is pragmatic knowledge of life or social decision making. The general knowledge and how do you make decisions. Emotional regulation. Just think about exact opposite of adolescence when the emotions fluctuate from minute to minute. Wisdom is emotional regulation. Pro-social attitudes and behavior. Compassion, empathy, altruism. Things that you do for others than for yourself. Reflection, self-understanding, knowing yourself, dealing effectively with uncertainty and ambiguity. You know, most situations in life are not black and white, they're gray, and still you have to act. And last is the tolerance of different value systems. You may have strong opinions about something, but you can understand why somebody may have different values. So this looks like... So these are the elements that seem to be shared by many definitions of wisdom going back to the ancient period. And that made us think that if the definition of wisdom has not changed considerably from the ancient times, going actually thousands of years BC to now, it probably means that it is not purely a cultural concept. That it's probably a biological concept. That it is rooted in biology. That means it is rooted in brain. I mean, where else... It could be if it exists, right? So we set out to find out where is the seat for wisdom in the brain. And without going into detail, so this was an article we published in JAMA last year, Wisdom from a Neuroscience Perspective. Again, I don't want to go into details of this. If there are questions, I'll be happy to answer later. But what we suggested is that there are some parts of the brain that are critical. So they are the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, ventromedial prefrontal cortex, anterior cingulate, and amygdala. Don't worry about the specific regions. What is interesting is that these three things, dorsolateral, ventromedial prefrontal, anterior cingulate, they are the newest part of the brain in evolution. That's a part of the brain that has grown largest in human beings. Whereas the other part, amygdala, and there is also some other reward circuitry that is involved, that's the oldest part of the brain. So, in other words, wisdom is really a balance between the newest and the oldest part of the brain. And in some ways it makes sense that there are some things like emotions that have existed in many species. You can see even in lower species that there is... However, the more rational thinking that characterizes humans is more recent, and that's probably related to the prefrontal cortex. So what is involved is a balance. You need intact social decision-making and knowledge, right? So that's prefrontal cortex. But you also need emotional regulation and compassion, empathy. So that's really the balancing between the oldest and the newest parts. Okay. Does wisdom, what happens to wisdom with aging? I started out by saying that some cognitive abilities go down with age, some say stable, but does anything increase? And there's actually some suggestion that wisdom may increase with aging. Baltes and Baltes, they did some pioneering work in Max Planck Institute. They found that new learning was possible in older adults. Several studies have shown that aging is associated with greater happiness, better mental health, better management of interpersonal relationship. And I'll show you some very recently published data that are relevant. There are two papers that are published in one of the major journals, Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. In this study, they looked at social reasoning in younger versus older adults. So what they did, they read some stories about social conflicts and predicted how these conflicts would unfold. They found that older people made greater use of higher order reasoning schemes that emphasize need for multiple perspectives, allowed for compromises, recognized the limits of knowledge. So social reasoning seemed to improve with age, although some memory and learning abilities were going down. The overall ability to solve social problems was better in older age because people could look at it in a more neutral, unbiased way and in a more compassionate way. So that's one. And this is even more recently published study, same journal, by a different group of researchers. They looked at two types of tasks. In one kind of task, you had to make the decision intuitively. You know, you had no idea what you were getting into, and you just had to make very quick judgment. Other kinds of tasks were those in which you had to think, and think logically based on your experience, and then make a decision. They found that younger people did better on the tasks that did not involve previous choices or experience. Older people did significantly better on tasks that involved previous experience, and not just experience, but using that experience appropriately. So for decisions that require experience, ability to use that experience optimally, older adults are better decision makers. I want to give one example. How many of you know this person? Yeah, many of you do. This is a pilot who became famous for what is called the miracle on Hudson. This happened 2 years ago. He was 58. 58 is not old, but for a pilot, it is close to the retirement age. That's why this is. He was flying this plane, and within minutes of its takeoff from LaGuardia Airport in New York, it felt like a flock of birds was sucked into both engines. Both engines failed, and he was told that he had 3 minutes to land. Otherwise, the plane would have crashed, and all the 155 people on board would have been killed. And actually, the air traffic controller asked him to go to New Jersey, and he said that he cannot do it in 3 minutes. So he made a decision to land on the Hudson River and did it exactly perfectly. It's amazing. And so everybody was safe and so on. Why could he do that? No 28-year-old or 38-year-old pilot could have done that. But he not only had experience, because he was an Air Force pilot, and he had some experience, especially in safety of the aircraft and so on and so forth. That ability to make a decision quickly based on the experience, carry out that decision in an unemotional way. He didn't get panicked. He controlled everybody else's anxieties also and executed to perfection. That's an example of wisdom that comes with age. So this is a hypothesis we actually propose in our paper in JAMA. Why should wisdom have anything to do with aging? Think about it this way, that humans have very long aging period, very long. Actually, the aging starts very early. For example, the knee cartilages, the aging starts at the age of 20. That's why some of those Olympic gymnasts, you see, they are in their teens. By the time they're 20, they're considered too old. And of course, then the memory, learning, etc., they start going down in the... Actually, some recent data suggests that starting at age 40, 50... So if you look at that, we have more period in a old age, however you define it, than in younger age. And what happens in old age? The physical health goes down, right? Some cognitive abilities go down. There is no fertility in very old age, postmenopausally, and in men also there is post-climacteric. So from the evolution point of view, age really doesn't have anything to add, right? Something must have to improve. So everything can't be going down. So what may be improving may be wisdom. And why does it improve? We'll talk about neuroplasticity next. But the wisdom allows us to reach the maximum lifespan in spite of physical disability, in spite of some cognitive abilities going down, and in spite of social stressor. And second is what is called the grandma hypothesis, which is that it allows the grandparents to transfer their wisdom and experience to the grandkid, which the parents can't do because the parents are so involved with the kids on a day-to-day basis, and they don't have the experience that only comes with age. So wisdom actually may have, I mean, this is all hypothesis, obviously, but it may have some important evolutionary significance. Okay. But how can anything get better with age? When I went to medical school a long time back, I was told that most of the growth and development of the brain occurred in utero, prenatally, and in the first few years of life. Mostly the first 2 years, the size of the head increases, the brain is growing. After that, there are some changes that continue. Even in adolescence, there are some changes. There is some synaptic pruning. But after 20, it's stable till about 50, 60, and then it's all downhill. There's all degeneration, and there is dementia and loss of neurons and synapses. That's what I was taught. There's really nothing you can do in old age. And the recent research showed that's not true, that there is something called neuroplasticity of aging, which means the brain continues to be plastic. That means it is moldable even in old age. We had done several reviews. We started with some literature reviews. My colleague Lisa Eiler, she did these reviews. And we find that using brain imaging studies, older people who do better have somewhat larger structures of brain, and those structures are more active in functional brain imaging. So why is it that some people do better than others? One is that probably they have greater brain reserve or cognitive reserve. Their brains are better from the beginning. That's not the only reason, though. Secondly, there is better compensation. Anytime you see people with stroke, that paralyzed, aphasic, etc., you see them 5 years later and they seem to be functioning almost normally. So what has happened? The rest of the brain takes over the part of the brain that died. So there is compensation. But even more exciting is the possibility that there may be formation of new neurons and synapses in old age. It's one of my favorite slides. This was a study. This work has been replicated in various places, but Rusty Gage, who is at Salk and UCSD, he took some old mice. Mice usually live up to 3 years. So these were between two and a half years mice. And usually you put four mice per cage. And then they get water and food continuously, and they don't have to do anything. They 24/7, all their lifetime, they are there. So what he did was he took some mice and randomly assigned some to these usual cages, and others he put in a kind of Disneyland for the mice. So large open field, they could run around, there were roller coasters, different colors, they had different choices. So they had a ball. He found that after 3 months, these mice had significantly better brains than these mice. They had more synapses and also more neurons in some parts of the brain. Not all over, but some parts. The dentate gyrus of the hippocampus and periventricular area. That's really amazing that in old mice, just giving them more physical activity and more fun activity could not improve, not merely improve the functioning of the brain, but structure of the brain. Can that occur in humans? This is a study published in the number one journal in science, which is Nature. This is in younger adults, but similar thing would apply to older people, probably to a lesser extent. But what they did was they took some volunteers from the street and randomized them to two groups. One group, and both groups were told to just continue their usual activity, but one group was taught, were told to juggle, try to juggle three balls at a time whenever they had a chance. And the other group was told not to bother with juggling. And they had structural MRI, the regular MRI that we have when we go for some head injury or whatever, before they started this and 3 months afterwards. What they found was after 3 months of juggling, these people had significant increase in the gray matter of one particular part of the parietal lobe that is associated with what is called perceptual anticipation. That means knowing where the ball is going to land. So that ability to anticipate where it will land and you stick your hand, there is a part of the parietal lobe that specifically is associated with that. And only in that region, there is significant increase in gray matter. So just something stupid like juggling for 3 months, it could produce significant increase in gray matter. We don't know what that means. I don't think it means increased neurons, but it probably means increase, may mean increasing number of synapses, blood vessels, but clearly some structural change. There's lots of studies showing physical exercise, how it affects the brain in a positive way. But does a mental activity change brain structure? This is a study in medical students who were taking their board examination. And they did an MRI 3 months before their boards. Most medical students, they don't study beforehand. They just, in the last 1 month, they study. So they had the MRI done the earlier, and then and they repeated it after the board examination. They found there's significant increase in the gray matter in several areas of the brain that are associated with learning. And they repeated that MRI actually 3 months further down, and they found that some of those changes actually had persisted that long. So studying for the boards, which means learning new things very actively, intently, purposefully, produce increase in gray matter. This is a study that showed meditation, after 11 hours of meditation, caused significant increase in fiber integrity using a specific type of brain imaging. These are all studies in normal people. This is a study of people with schizophrenia who were given psychotherapy. After 1 year of psychotherapy, so this is the control group that did not receive the psychotherapy, and this is the group that received psychotherapy. You see these red areas? These are the areas in which there is significant increase in gray matter. So even psychotherapy, even in people with schizophrenia, can increase the gray matter volume in specific parts of the brain. I mean, isn't that mind-boggling? And the other studies that showed that psychotherapy increase what is called BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor. So it is almost like putting your brain on a treadmill through psychotherapy or other cognitive activities. Okay, lastly, so what are the implications or what can we learn from this in terms of what we should do or can do? So the general strategies of successful aging, first one is my least favorite one, which is calorie restriction. But unfortunately, this is the most evidence-based strategy, calorie restriction. Then comes physical exercise, again, second most evidence-based. Third is optimizing stress, reducing the stress, not eliminating. Then there is something called superfood that are rich in antioxidants, things like broccoli, vitamin E, curcumin, which is an Indian spice that you see that is included in some curries, for example. So these are antioxidant-rich foods. Psychosocially stimulating environment is never too late nor too early to start. I want to talk about actually some psychosocial things. So physical and other things are fine, but what about these? Levy, she did some studies at Yale University, and her studies were on attitude toward aging in older people. And she found that negative associated attitude was associated with greater cardiovascular response to stress. Those who had positive attitude lived 7.5 years longer than those who had negative attitude. And this is the most interesting thing. She did a randomized controlled trial in which the investigators tried to induce positive attitude, kind of psychotherapy, but to teach people how to have positive attitude. And they found that after that, there was significant decrease in biological markers of cardiovascular stress. So this is something that actually you can try and improve. What about wisdom? There's a kind of a social experiment that is going on that's called Experience Score. What they are doing is that they take some older adult volunteers over the age of 65 who have retired. They have to agree to spend at least 15 hours a week in public elementary schools in downtown. These are often kids who, let alone grandparents, they don't even often have both parents, sometimes not even one parent. So these older adults, they serve as their mentors and tutors, literacy development, behavior management skills. And they found that over a period of a few years, these kids' grades improved significantly. But also the older adults, they found that very helpful. So for them, emotionally, that was satisfying, and their functioning level improved too. Great way of sort of, it's a win-win situation, both for the younger generation and the older generation. So this is my last slide. So what should we do? Obviously, there is no single one-size-fits-all. I mean, we have to find out for ourselves what we like to do. But we should continue doing some work that is self-satisfying. I think the trick is not doing something that is stressful, but at the same time, it needs to be challenging. If it is too easy, that's not good enough. Community service is an example. People who have hobbies and they couldn't do those things for years because of their work, now they can go back. Mentoring trainees, younger colleagues, learning new techniques. And I think in some ways, serenity and this greater satisfaction in old age, I think it boils down to the serenity prayer. Serenity to accept the things one cannot change, courage to change the things one can, and wisdom to know the difference. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.